On this episode of Baseball Barbicast, we have a wonderful interview with our pal, Yuri Karasawa, from Yaku Cosmopolitan and Japan Ball to preview the latest wave of Japanese stars making their way from NPB to MLB. We also go around the league, talk about the Grayson Rodriguez to the Angels trade. Oh, how good is Taylor Ward? Oh, what are the Braves up to? Oh, four guys accepted the QO? And then, of course, it's Friday, so we give you the good, the bad, the ugly. All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbicast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbicast, the only baseball podcast in the world who knows that the USPS has the best posting system in the country. I'm Jake Mitz. That's Jordan Schusterman. And is that a posting system?
Yeah, definitely a distinction between the postal system versus a posting system. I never really thought about those words as being similar. But on this Friday edition of Baseball Barbicast, the posting system is going to become quite relevant as we delve deep into the latest wave of Japanese baseball stars coming this way to this side of the globe to take their talents to Major League Baseball. And who better to join us and talk to us about these players than Mr. Yaku Cosmo himself? Yuri Karasawa will join us and tell us all about at least three of the Japanese players heading from NPB to MLB this winter. That will be Munetaka Murakami, that will be Kazuma Okamoto, that will be Tatsuya Imai. And yes, we will also spend some time with Yuri talking about that Yamamoto fella who certainly had himself a nice little World Series.
Earned it.
That we figured that we should spend some time recapping. So that is going to be the bulk of this episode. Is there anything else we want to set up with our lengthy convo with Yuri before we send it over there?
Yeah, I think it's just worth looking a little bit big picture at where we're at in the offseason with the posting system, right? So the way it works is that the Japanese teams have to post their players, make them available to the MLB teams. And once they are officially posted, once they click send on the tweet or whatever, they have the players have a certain amount of time within which they can sign. Once that clock runs out, the player, I believe, then just would return to NPB. Now, that's not going to happen with any of these players. But the reason it's relevant is because we know that they will sign by a certain date. It is a 45-day window, I believe. And so, like, it's a definitive timeline. It is one of the few things in the offseason that we can absolutely no doubt count on. And then I guess the other main thing to point out is that, you know, the number and the rate and the flow of players coming over from Japan has undoubtedly increased over the last decade or so. You know, most years in the past, we had one guy, maybe two, maybe zero. And now we have three who are looking like impact players, and there may be even a handful more that are going to join them.
Yeah, and this is why Yuri's work at his own website, at Japan Ball, his YouTube channel, covering Japanese baseball in English is just incredible. And there have been other, you know, sites that have done this. Jim Allen, and like this has existed, but now that this is essentially an annual thing that we are experiencing, the level of detail and the almost seamless kind of overlap now, where it's like, all right, you want to see like baseball savant style sliders for these players, like Yuri's got them for you. You know, like you can, it all feels so much closer, which is appropriate, you know, and that was even true. Not that we didn't have the baseball internet and some of these resources 10 years ago, but now it just all feels so much more connected and so much more relevant. And that is why his insight into really the more historical context and trajectories of these players is really important, because it's, we can only do so much. You know, we can watch highlights, we can look at stats, but it's to really know what to expect from these players. And you never really know. I mean, this is true for any free agent.
Sure.
You kind of got to know their story. And I think Yuri does a great job of helping provide that context.
And there's no better example of being like, this is important than the World Series this year, right? Like, this is not some far off far-flung thing. I mean, it is a far-off, far-flung place from where we sit on the east and north coasts. But the timeline here is very quick, right? Yamamoto went from being posted and getting the largest contract in the history of the sport for a pitcher to not single-handedly winning the World Series, but doing quite a large part in bringing it home for the Dodgers in 24, but particularly in 25. All right, Jordan, I think that's about it. I think we just let's toss the rock to ourselves and to Yuri and let that speak for itself.
Yes, indeed. Our opener is our conversation with Yuri. What a treat it is to welcome back this very special guest. His name is Yuri Karasawa. He is joining us from Japan, where he is going to dole out wisdom as only he can about the latest wave of NPB stars making their way to MLB. Yuri, welcome back to Baseball Barbercast. We're so happy to have you back on.
Yeah, thank you guys so much for having me on. It was a lot of fun last year, and I'm excited to talk about the Japanese players coming over to MLB again this winter.
Yuri, you are quite literally living in the future. It is a whole other day where you are sitting. And so you're the perfect person to tell us what's going to happen. I would say let's just start big picture before we jump into any of the specific players coming over. We're seeing kind of a steadier flow of players making the leap from NPB to MLB. I would say in the last decade, if you rewind, it was probably maybe one a year, maybe one big player every other year. And now we're getting multiple players every winter. I guess I'll just ask, what do you make of that trend? And is it in any way concerning for the Japanese baseball apparatus that is fearing that it is losing talent to America?
That's a really good question, right? And if you compare, say, to 10 years ago, where a lot of the best superstars in MPB, say, Yuki Yanagita, Tetsuro Yamada, Hayato Sakamoto, these guys who were more than good enough to go to MLB, they decided to spend their entire careers in Japan. You just don't see that anymore. And Okamoto is a perfect example of this because he's the first position player ever posted by the Omiuri Giants. Just 5-10 years ago, that was almost unthinkable that this would happen. Even Imai, I think midway through the year, we weren't really sure if he was going to get posted. But it's kind of become a given now that if you're good in Japan, you're going to go over to MLB. Now, part of that is finances. It's continuing to kind of grow this gap in terms of the high-end contracts in MLB versus MPB. MPB's minimum contracts and the baseline stuff is good, but the superstars just aren't getting what you can possibly get with these mega deals in MLB. So that's a big part of it. I do think it's somewhat concerning that MPB is continuing to lose a lot of players, but I will say the pipeline is still very, very healthy. You still got a lot of young stars. For every star that MPB loses, it's gaining a new one, 18, 19 year olds. And you obviously have the stuff with Rintaro Sasaki and Shotaro Mori as well, these guys who decided not to initially come to MPB. So I think that's a slightly bigger concern that they've already kind of addressed with, you saw Rintaro Sasaki actually became MPB draft eligible while at Stanford, and he was actually drafted by the Fukuoka SoftBank Hawks, although he doesn't have to come to MPB. That's a decision that he'll be making next year.
So just one quick follow-up on that from bird's eye view. So stateside, there's been such a big conversation about the financial windfall that the Dodgers and the league in general have experienced from the boost in fandom and MLB fandom from Japan. Has Japan baseball, which I know is a broad thing, seen any financial benefit itself? I know it is, the most popular sport in the country and has been for a century, but it has the popularity of the sport there grown in turn, or are fewer people watching NPB because they're waking up early to watch the Dodgers?
I think it's kind of closer to the second one you mentioned in terms of there is a much bigger like casual audience now for Major League Baseball that you just didn't see before. In the past, it was like, okay, if you're a baseball diehard and you want to see your favorite Japanese player, then you're going to go and watch MLB. But now people who don't really care that much about baseball are interested in what Ohtani and the Dodgers are doing, because the Dodgers are kind of this, you know, mini Samurai Japan team. Granted, there's a lot of, there's, you know, 15 Japanese players in MLB. The Dodgers only have three of them, but they do happen to have basically the three best, at least in terms of like talent. So that's a big part of it. Yeah, I mean, in terms of MPB, it's still incredibly popular. Average attendance in MPB is higher than in MLB. A lot of people don't realize that. So it's still, you know, doing very well. But I do think in terms of how much MLB has exploded in Japan, Ohtani and the Dodgers have had a huge part to do with that.
And we are going to do a little bit of Yamamoto chat later, because yeah, we're going to kind of keep the Ohtani, yeah, we're going to keep the Ohtani discussion to a relative minimum here. Of course, he probably deserves his own podcast all the time. There's no wrong time to talk about Ohtani, but let's kind of dig into these new faces, because that's what people want to know about as we are talking about free agency this week and digging into to just, you know, what does the future look like for these players? So we're going to focus on three. Again, it's more than just three. I know Kona Takahashi is another one, a reliever to kind of keep an eye on. And there's some former MLB players who are coming back from Asia. You know, Anthony Kay of the Bay Stars. I'm rocking the Bay Stars hat for our guy, Anthony Kay. And, you know, Cody Ponce, who was in NPB and KBO. We're going to focus on the three big names who have been stars in Japan for multiple seasons and are now making the leap here and expect to sign pretty sizable major league free agent contracts. That is Munetaka Murakami. That is Kazuma Okamoto, and that is Tetsuya Imai. Let's start with Murakami, because I think this is the guy who
Can I hop in first, please. Very quickly? Yes. If at any point these two gaijin mispronounce any name significantly, please hop in and let us know.
Yeah, how'd I do
there? You
guys
are doing a pretty good job so far. Pretty good job.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. I know Kazuma versus Kazuma, I've heard that's probably a misstep on my end in the past. Did I get that one correct?
You got that one correct. And I'll be honest, like with American players in Japan, Japanese people are not necessarily pronouncing those names correctly either. So I think it's a two-way street. Everyone's okay. We all have respect for each other. Yeah.
Great. There we go. Love that attitude. All right. So let's get into these players. Let's talk about Murakami, because I do think that this is the player, appropriately so, because this is the profile. But the discourse around this gentleman has truly exploded in all kinds of different directions. And again, the dude was posted like a week ago. Most of the people talking about him have, of course, never seen him play. But now we're like, oh, what do you mean? We know these players. I've seen a couple clicks on him. I've looked at his Fangraphs page. I've read this scouting report. And listen, there are, of course, good reports coming out from people on this side of the pond. I don't doubt that. But as someone who has watched this guy's essentially entire career and followed the ups and downs, where are you? How are you feeling? Because does it feel like this has gotten out of hand? And it's, by the way, we're only just beginning. We got at least another few weeks of this, probably. But as you watch, because you're online just like us, and you're kind of seeing where this conversation is going, for this player who has all these home run records and just, I mean, essentially, I imagine, considered one of the greatest Japanese home run hitters of all time, right? We're just talking about home run hitters. But because he strikes out more than not just basically everybody in Japan, but anyone is right now in terms of contact rates in Major League Baseball at a consistent level. Have we gone too far in one direction, or do you think that the discourse right now is at a fair place where some people are saying this guy has no chance versus this guy is obviously going to hit 74 home runs one day?
Murakami is one of the most polarizing players in the world, I think, and for good reason. Like, everyone's going to make their opinions known about him, which I think is good. I mean, it's healthy for the discourse. Early on, we were seeing people be like, this is Babe Ruth. And then now we've seen the pendulum swing to where people are like, this is a guaranteed bust. This guy sucks. And I'm going to be honest, it's not really either of those. There is some nuance to this. In terms of his ability, his colossal power, this guy's a generational talent. There's no doubt about that. You don't run into 56 homers in dead ball MPB. And then his down years are like 30, 35 homers. And MPB seasons are shorter. also. So 143 games is an MLB season as opposed to 162. So, I mean, 2022 in a full MLB season with livelier balls, like this guy would have been on pace for like 65. That's the kind of power he has. And I think in MLB, he is one of the very few like players you could say has 50 homer upside. But the swing and miss is genuine. It's not just like strikeouts either. He was first percentile in in-zone contact rate this past year, which is obviously very poor compared to the likes of, say, a Suzuki, who were, you know, 90% in-zone contact. Murakami's all the way down at 73, which, yeah, you're getting into your Joey Gallo-type territory in terms of the swing and miss. But we can't lose sight of the fact that this guy is a generational talent. He has a ton of potential to really become a superstar in MLB.
We'll ask you about the swing and miss stuff again in a second, but I want to know more about Murakami, the character. He has been relatively well known in the States amongst baseball fans for a couple of years now, since he hit 56 home runs, broke the Japanese home run record for a native player. When does he get famous over there? Is this someone who, as a teenager, was like Bryce Harper-y, where he was on magazine covers as a teen? Or did he just kind of come out of nowhere as this big swinging slugger?
So it's funny, right? In 2017, the MPB draft, there was sort of this big three of high school sluggers. It was a pretty special year in terms of high school talent. You had Kotaro Kiyomiya, who had won the 2012 Little League World Series as a two-way player. He is now a masher for the Hokkaido Nippon Ham Fighters. There was Hisanori Yasuda, who is now with the Lotte Marines. And then there was this catcher named Munetaka Murakami from Kumamoto. And because he comes from a slightly, you know, lesser region, I think the hype on him was nowhere near what it was for Kiyomiya. But he immediately raked on the farm, the minors here in 2018. And then his rookie year, he hit 36 home runs. So immediately it was clear that this guy is something special to hit that many homers as a teenager. And then he was already on like the Olympic team by 2021. So really ever since this guy's been 19, 20 years old, he's started to get recognized in Japan, and he quickly did surpass his counterparts in Kiyomiya and Yasuda, just in terms of, you know, putting up just raw production, you know, in the power department.
I think it's also important for our listeners who aren't as familiar with the basic scouting report. You mentioned him as a catcher. I don't know if he caught literally any games at the highest level or how long that fizzled out, but give us a little bit of a background about his kind of defensive profile and trajectory. And then I want to get back to the strikeouts, because there's another name that I think we want to bring up when we talk about comps.
You're right that he did not catch at the professional level at all. He moved off the position very quickly, started playing a lot of first base, and then they tried him at third, and he was decent enough to where they've kept him there for the majority of his MPB career. Occasionally, like late in a game, the team will do like a defensive swap and a better guy goes to third, he goes over to first, but he's been a third baseman for basically his entire career because he played in the Central League, which until 2027, does not have a designated hitter. So Murakami's kind of been forced to play defense. And as I'm sure everyone's read in the scouting reports, things like footwork, mobility, range, not really there at third base. He does project much more like a first baseman or even a DH.
And then from an offensive perspective, the name that popped up for Jordan and I as we started kind of digging in a little bit was Nick Kurtz. Nick Kurtz, who came up this year with the A's, tons of swing and miss, but like otherworldly power, where no one is sitting here right now and being like, man, Nick Kurtz, I don't know, man, he's got a lot of swing and miss, right? When the power is at that level, it can do some very special things. So I guess my question is this. The current approach and swing mechanics are not viable. Like if he rolls into MLB and doesn't change a thing, it will be closer to bad Joey Gallo than it will be Nick Kurtz. Do you think that he is capable of making those adjustments based upon what you have seen from him over the years in Japan?
I think he's very capable of the adjustment. He's only 25 years old, going to be 26 in his first MLB season. And I actually love the Nick Kurtz comp. I've mentioned people like, Schwarber, Max Muncy, Rafael Devers. These are like the high end possibilities for a Murakami. Now on the lower end, you get to like a bad Joey Gallo or a bad Miguel Sano type season. But even then, like, those guys could still run into a homer and you know, put up like counting stats in that department. It's more of like the batting average and the on-base threat is obviously not good. He hasn't really had to make adjustments in MPB, right? Because if you're OPSing 1,000 every year, like, why would you change anything? So that doesn't mean he can't. It just means he hasn't had to. 2023, 2024, these were slightly down years by his standards, which I just think a lot of that can be mental. You know, coming off the high of 2022, when you won back-to-back MVPs, when you've won a Japan series, when you just set the single-season Japanese-born home run record, what else is there to really try to strive for? You're going to really try to, you know, put too much pressure on yourself.
It's like what happened with Mookie over here.
Yeah.
Like 2020, 2021, 22, Mookie is just like, I've unlocked this. Right. Yeah. And it wasn't until Mookie really moved back to the infield where we saw him like fully reinvigorate as a player. Yeah. That is super interesting to hear you talk about something similar with him.
I think that's a big part of it. And also at the World Baseball Classic, some people mentioned that perhaps he got like imposter syndrome almost from being next to Otani and being like, oh, I'm not as good as this guy. Even though I think in terms of power, you could argue that Murakami has just as much as Otani. And certainly in MPB, Murakami is a better hitter than Otani was in MPB.
Which, if that's true, boy, am I looking forward to Murakami's BP, because oh my God, Shohei's BP that we were lucky enough to see during the World Series in Toronto, which he obviously doesn't do on the field very often, in the very short list of best batting practices that we've ever seen. And I know, but to your point, like, that's also something that's probably improved for Shohei over the past 6-7 years, relative to, not that he wasn't hitting the ball hard far in Japan, but I think that's even leveled up.
Hit more home runs this year than he did in his entire NPB career.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, that's a smaller sample size for games.
Sure.
Or at least in total, and he was doing more pitching and all that stuff. But yeah, I mean, and then that's the last thing on Murakami, and then we're going to move on to the other hitter is, yeah, I mean, I just think that Kurtz comp is compelling, because the other key here to sustaining a profile like that is drawing walks, right? And maybe you are whiffing a lot in the zone, if that is part of your approach, but Nick Kurtz also had a 73% in-zone contact rate this year, right? And that's still a unanimous Rookie of the Year. So I still think that there's reasons to think that Murakami will need to make some level of adjustment for sure. But it's not impossible. If you are doing that much damage when you are making contact, you can strike out a lot. So I'll give you the final word on him here. I guess also just, you mentioned sort of the personality, maybe quirks, and just his journey as far as just like where his place is in Japanese baseball. I think that's also a compelling thing we'll get into with some of these other guys. But yeah, we had so many conversations last year when we had you on talking about Roki, about like what kind of fit is he? And I always feel a little bit uncomfortable ascribing some of these things. Oh, he can't make it in the New York, or he needs to go somewhere a little bit more comfortable. That said, because I think you have a better sense for some of these personalities, I don't know. Do you sense that this is someone that would embrace, you know, being a Yankee, that would embrace? Again, I sound like I'm trying to chase the headline here, but I'm truly curious if you have a sense for what kind of environment you think he maybe could thrive in.
Because like, like from what we see in the English language side on the internet is like clip of Murakami with subtitles of him on a talk show, you know, inferring that he wants to be on the West Coast. And it's like, how much of that is smoke and how much of that is fire, I guess is the question.
That interview I think you're referring to, he did right after that 2022 season. And it was kind of funny because he mentioned, you know, he was just kind of asked on the show, like, oh, you want to go to MLB? And he's like, yeah, I'm interested in a West Coast team like the Yankees. And then they were like, wait, but the Yankees aren't on the West Coast? So it was just kind of like, you know, I don't think there's much to read into it. I think he was just kind of like, on the spot and just kind of got it wrong.
Yeah.
But yeah, to your point, you know, I don't think he would benefit from a place where he gets like booed constantly. Like that's the one thing I'll say. Like if he takes an 0 for 4 with 4Ks and is getting booed that's by his own fans, I don't think that's going to help. Right. You know, I don't think that's going to help. Right. Not that he can't, not that he's not, you know, mentally tough enough to get through that, but I do think he benefits from like a more positive environment as opposed to a guy like Okamoto, who we'll get into next, who's kind of played in this like high pressure, you know, Yomiuri Giants kind of being the equivalent of the Yankees. But, you know, Murakami with the Swallows, their team wasn't particularly good over the last 2 years. And he still put up numbers, you know, and the chase rate you talked about a little earlier, he was 70th percentile in chase rate this year. So it is above average plate skills. And for a lot of his career, he was even better than that. I think he has good swing decisions. He can almost be too passive at times. I think, you know, a big part of his success is going to be recognizing when a pitch is something that he can drive and then obviously putting it over the fence.
All right. So let's move to Okamoto, who you just mentioned. And he now becomes indirectly an interesting character as a figure of comparison. And that's just a matter of circumstance, right? That's not anything personal with Murakami or really is maybe fair. And if Okamoto was the only hitter we were talking about, maybe we would be talking about him in a little bit more of a straightforward way. But because he is a few years older and because his strikeout rate is literally half or less than half of Murakami's, it is very easy for casual fans starting to introduce themselves to this player. And this is a third baseman with the Yomiuri Giants, who I think will be 30 next year, who's, again, a much longer career in MPB, maybe not quite the highs, but has been one of the best hitters in Japan for a long time, where it's like, well, why would I go out of my way to get this guy who might be a bust immediately when this guy seems like a plug-and-play hitter? So give us a little bit of sense, kind of Jake's question about his status as a character in Japanese baseball. I mean, how high of a level are we talking? Obviously, he's been around for a long time. He's had some good seasons. Is he considered like inner circle, like this is one of the best players in Japan? Or is this just like this guy's really good and we can count on him being really good and we expect him to continue being really good when he goes to MLB?
Certainly within Giants franchise history, he's become one of the greats to hit cleanup for, you know, this historic franchise. And to do it at such a high level, he had six straight seasons of 30 plus homers. He hit 27 last year and then 15 this year, but that was due to injury. And another funny part to mention is, as you said, there's so many parallels that people are going to make between him and Murakami because they're going over at the same time, both corner infielders, both sluggers. They're also really good friends. They've played together at the WBC, obviously. A lot of people, you know, point out like video of them just like being bros. Like these guys are really good friends. So I don't think, you know, if people want to like look at them as like rivals, they're definitely not. Like, right. They are really good friends. They're tight with each other. But yeah, I mean, Okamoto, really the only downside with him is that he's going to be 30 next year. You know, that's really the only thing you could say about him. And then I guess that he doesn't have necessarily much defensive value. People are saying that he's a good defender. I would say that's a little, you know, maybe too kind. Like, he's fine. He's better than Murakami, certainly. He's not a DH. He can play a little bit of third. He can play a little bit of left field. He's a pretty good first baseman, but he's still not going to be giving you crazy defensive value. It is mostly going to be coming with the bat. He's good at lifting the ball. He's good at pulling the ball. You know, these are good traits that a lot of MLB sluggers have.
But that's also what's funny is what you say there is it's, again, not his fault, but the comparisons in some times are helping him out. And in other times, because of the age, it's like, oh, he's going to be 30. It's like, that's a normal age for a free agent. You know, like he's not Murakami's age where, and we know age is a huge part of these calculations for teams, but he's not 35. We're not talking about him at the very end and he's going to get a 1 year deal. He's the same age as most of these others. He's younger than Pete Alonso, you know? And so when we're talking about these kind of deals and what kind of, again, I'm not asking you to project the kind of contract he's going to get, but what's your confidence level? You know, is the expectation that he could be a Suzuki type? That's kind of what I'm seeing. I know Suzuki was striking out more, and I know he was younger when he came over also, but maybe he does end up with a 4 or 5 year deal in the, you know, 50 to 80 million and could hit fifth or sixth for a good team. Is that a realistic expectation?
I think so. And I think it's fair to call him as like, you know, maybe like a slightly less athletic version of a Seiya. Like Seiya, I know nowadays, because he doesn't, you know, play much outfield, people don't view him as such, but he was like a very athletic guy. He came up as a shortstop, Seiya Suzuki did. So Okamoto is not that. He doesn't have that build. But in terms of the bat, I am quite confident that he can hit the ground running. Now, how does the contract look 4 or 5 years down the line? I don't know, but he has had his peak years over the past 2 to 3 years. I mean, these have been his best seasons by far in terms of like weighted runs created plus. And actually, if you look from just 2023, Murakami's a 162 WRC plus and Okamoto's a 180. So Okamoto's been almost 20% better than Murakami has over the past 3 seasons. It's just that you go back one more year before that and Murakami had a 230 WRC plus, you know, an Aaron Judge, like Barry Bonds type season. Yeah, right. So Okamoto's ceiling is not there. Like, he has a much higher floor, but also a much lower ceiling, in my opinion.
So when you go to Okamoto's baseball reference page, Sean, do you have it up?
I can.
Something very interesting stands out that I want to ask you about, Yuri. He has played on the Yomiuri Giants his entire life. He has 34 games on one other team, and that was in the Puerto Rican Winter League as a 20-year-old playing for Gigantes de Carolina. With Kike, he was on this team with Kike and Daisuke Matsuzaka and two or three other Japanese players that appear to have just like gone over and played in Puerto Rico for a winter. One, what? Two, how about that?
Yeah, I actually didn't like know that he played with Kike and Daisuke. That's funny. But yeah, you know, Japanese players, if they're very young, you'll see them often play winter ball in either Puerto Rico or Australia. Seeing that, you know, pretty common, even in recent years. They don't typically go to like Dominican Republic, sometimes Venezuela, but usually it is Puerto Rico and Australia.
Dude, there's totally a picture of Kike like messing around with Okamoto somewhere. Just keep that in the back of your head. Yeah. My last question about him is in relation to the Giants. So you mentioned before that they've historically been really hesitant to post players. My question is, why? And why are they bucking that trend now by posting Okamoto?
Yeah, so they've had an anti-posting policy basically because they don't need the money, historically speaking. It's like, you know, we're one of the wealthier franchises in MPB. If we post one of our stars, it kind of sets a bad precedent. It shows that we're not like the big dog here. Like we're not like you small market MPB teams that need to post your players to MLB. Like we're not gonna let Americans poach us. But I do think we've hit a time where this is starting to change. And the only anti-posting team left is SoftBank, but let's just say I wouldn't be shocked if this changes in the next 5 years either. And Okamoto, had he not been posted this year, he would have become an international free agent after 2026. So I think that's a big part of it, is that he could have just left on his own and then they wouldn't have had any posting money. So why not do your franchise superstar a favor and let him go before the lockout?
Right. And then obviously we're constantly wrangling with how next offseason is impacting this offseason. And that is an interesting potential tentacle of that. How many guys have we, again, it's totally their right. But like, I think you mentioned one of them earlier. How many Giants legends probably could have come over? I imagine that there's a good number that MLB will never know.
Yeah. I mean, if you go back to the 60s when they had a dynasty, I mean, you know, Sadaharu Oh, who I think is probably the most big one. Sure. The most, you know, well-known giant, like probably in the world, Shigeo
Nagashima.
Former
future Yankee. Sadaharu Oh.
And then even just in, recent years, right? But I mean, like, They did go over, obviously, like with Hideki Matsui. It just happened to be like not through the posting system. So.
Sure. A little bit of a different one.
All right. We're going to take a quick break and we'll have more Japanese baseball chat with Yuri when we're back.
right, let's move to our final player, at least final free agent, and then we'll get to Yamamoto. And that is Tatsuya Imai, the right-handed pitcher for the Cebu Lions. And this is one you mentioned earlier, also was not obvious that he was going to come over. So unlike Murakami, where a year ago we knew we were basically looking forward to this, Imai conveniently then has essentially his best season while also then approaching the possibility where like, oh, wait, no, they really might post him. So this kind of came on a little bit later, a little over the second half of the season, where he starts to become a name that MLB fans are going to need to know. What was the big leap forward for him this season? How relevant and prominent was he before he had this breakout year? And where is he right now after this season, even before he leaves Japan? Is he considered, I know statistically, pretty strong case that he had the best season of any pitcher there, or one of the handful. But yeah, how quickly did he kind of work himself into that conversation of the best or one of the best pitchers in Japan?
The two things that really stands out about what he did in 2025 compared to the early part of his career is better command. So he got the walk rate to a career best 7% as opposed to 11.5% for his career, which is obviously not very good. That's a very wild pitcher. And then he improved his splits against left-handed hitters. So he's always been a guy that kills righties because he has this, running fastball and then a great slider, the reverse slider, as Lance Brozdowski has coined it. So he was always great against righties, but struggled with his splits to lefties. Kind of improved his secondaries with the changeup, with the splitter, with the Vulcan, and made him a more complete player. And I think when you look at his overall season in MPB this year, like certainly no doubt that it was like a top three pitching season. Now, he didn't win the Sawamura Award, which is, often looked at as like MPB Cy Young equivalent because you need more innings and stuff like that. That went to Hiromi Ito of the Fighters. But, in terms of just pure being like dominant, I mean, he was 88th percentile in called strike plus whiff rate among pitchers with at least 50 innings. So that even includes like elite relievers. He was 88th percentile in called strike plus whiff rate. He was strikeout rate minus walk rate rather, and then 87th percentile in fielding independent pitching minus. So a lot of these like great indicators, underlying indicators of success, he had all of them.
So I'll ask about the hair.
Oh, that's good. Yeah.
So the hair freaking rules. The hair rules it. For those of you who have not seen it, it is luscious. They are particularly flowy locks. Is that something that, has he always had big hair, long hair? And is he known for the hair?
It's funny because the guy he's getting posted with, his teammate, Kona Takahashi, also has long hair. And this is actually, it was a conversation among like Cebu shareholders a couple years ago. Like, should we allow our players to have, such luscious long hair? Like, is that really professional of them?
Or do we want to be losers?
Yeah. So it's been a conversation there. He hasn't always had it. I think it was like 3 or 4 years ago that he grew it out. Then he kind of cut it and then he kind of grew it out again. He had, he certainly gained aura points for that. Like he's okay. Been a better pitcher with the hair. I'll say that much. And obviously like it's even more rare to see like that kind of like style in Japan, where especially at like the amateur level, like the norm is to like almost like shave your head. So it stands out about him for sure.
I want to dig back in on, you mentioned kind of improving against lefties and you mentioned that change in splitter. What stood out to me when I started digging in on Imai a couple months ago was, at least according to the sources that I'm looking at, when you look at the pitch mix, it was like 70 to 80% fastball slider. And you mentioned that those fastball slider are really good, but that felt unique relative to a lot of the other Japanese pitchers that we've seen come over that, I mean, almost to a comical degree in the case of Darvish, having 12 different pitches or whatever, but even Otani's throwing 6 or 7 and Yamamoto, it's at least 5. And even Senga, for as much of the, forkball and ghost fork, whatever, he was still throwing a good number of cutters and sliders and whatever. Am I wrong in assessing that does make him sort of unique? And how much confidence is there that those other pitches can kind of come along and help him? Because, the lefties he's going to face in MLB are obviously that much better. And how important do you think that is going to be to his development? Or do you think that the fastball slider is good enough to be a Hunter Green or a Strider or Dylan Cease? Because those pitchers do exist in MLB. It just feels a little bit more unique in Japan.
Yeah, I think it's certainly unique in Japan. You almost never see that for a starter, except Roki Sasaki's one, who basically was just like essentially a two-pitch guy. I mean, he mixes in the slider every now and then, but it was basically fastball splitter for him. For Imai, though, I do think he needs the better secondaries just because the slider is not as platoon neutral. But it is a very unique pitch. The backwards or reverse slider, like with the arm side movement, and he's purposely kind of designed this pitch to be exactly that. Like, he used to have a bit more sweep to it, but then he mentioned over the past, I think it was 2 years ago, that he tightened it up and really kind of made it the shorter slider because it tunnels better with his fastball. And then he has that obviously lower arm angle as well that helps out. But he really needs to continue to make improvements, I think, to the changeup, which was a great ground ball pitch for him this year. And then the splitter is good, but he doesn't have that much comfort throwing it just based on the usage. I mean, it's well below 10%. So there's that. And then he was tinkering and just, like, again, he added the Vulcan change like in September of this year. Like, to me, that's proof that he was, you know, looking for more offerings. Like, he's not necessarily set as who he is, and he's probably going to add a pitch in MLB as well. Maybe, you know, a true two seam or
sure.
Reintroduce the cutter or something like that.
Which my last Imai question, then we'll go to Yamamoto, is again personality wise. You've posted two things about Imai in the last few weeks that really grabbed my attention. One. was a quote that I'm sure you're translating here on pitching in the dead ball era in NPB. And so I'll just read this quote. This is that from you posted. And I just love that this kind of give a little perspective into his mindset. Quote, "I didn't always dream of going to MLB. Over the past 2 to 3 years, I felt like there weren't many hitters who were even trying to hit a homer off me anymore. A lot of lineups would just foul pitches off and run up my pitch count. I get that's a valid part of strategy, but if I were a fan, I don't think that kind of baseball is very fun to watch. Personally, I love power versus power matchups." So you see kind of two things there from in that answer. And I don't know what the exact context was that he shared this opinion, but just the premise of he's like, you know what? Like, I kind of want to go do the more of the MLB style where it's like, here's my, you know, best shit. Let's see if I can get it past you. And he felt that the approaches against him were just like, all right, whatever. I wonder about that too, in as it relates to his improvement in his command and the walk rate, because I wonder if he's like, well, if I just throw it over, they might just bunt or ground out to the right side. You know, I don't think he's going to be able to do that as much against MLB hitters, but it seems like he's got the right mindset to kind of go after the best hitters in the world.
The mentality is definitely there. I mean, he's a dog. Should have mentioned that he had a 17 strikeout game this year, which broke Daisuke Matsuzaka's franchise record with Seibu. I mean, he just had so many like double-digit strikeout games, working deep into games. And as you mentioned, like, yeah, I mean, with how dead the balls are in MPB, and I think fans are maybe even underestimating that in the U.S. Like, I know there's been the discussion that like MLB's balls are kind of dead in this past year, right? Because it's like the MPB league ERA over the past 3 years, the league average ERA is below 3. So if you have an ERA of 3, you are below average in MPB. So, I mean, that is a very big difference. But yeah, I mean, I think Imai is definitely, he desires like the spotlight. He wants these, again, the power on power matchups. Like, that's going to entertain him, and that's going to give him like more motivation and drive to continue improving.
And then the next day you just posted, fun fact, Tetsuya Imai is also a high level Mahjong player, which, with a screenshot of him competing in some high-level Mahjong tournament. I love that you just posted this and did not provide any more follow-up. So now I'm asking you two, is there anything else we need to know about his Mahjong career?
I believe that's like a Mahjong like TV show where like celebrities who play it at a high level compete against each other. And I did see like a clip of him actually winning one of these times. Now, I don't know enough about Mahjong to really say how high level he is, but
neither do we. But it's,
I think he is very high
attention.
IQ because, you know, if you view it as like him being like a chess player, obviously, you know, he's thinking at a very deep level.
Mahjong is just like, oh, it's great. And maybe it'll become like a Mookie level, like bowling type hobby.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
We'll see if they start playing that in the clubhouse.
He needs to get more. He needs to get more Americans and like Hispanic players to play it.
We'll see. We'll see. Or he'll just like start dominating, you know, dominoes or whatever. All right. We have two more quick topics for you. This one is very simple. Obviously, you are in Japan, you know, they are just Ohtani, deservedly so. And when we tied you on a year ago, we had, of course, the Roki mania. What's going to happen with Roki? However, their teammate, Yoshinobu Yamamoto, stole the show during the World Series in a way that Jake and I will certainly never forget, having been fortunate enough to be in the building for all of it. And so a very simple question. How about that? What was your reaction to what Yamamoto did in the World Series? And what has been the reaction back home? Obviously, he was very famous already and was already considered one of the greatest pitchers in MVP history. But what did that do for his status there? Or was it just like, yeah, duh, of course he did that?
Yeah, I mean, with Yamamoto, like, I told you so, right? Like, this guy was so clearly, like, arguably the best Japanese player pitcher ever, like coming out of NPB, and obviously the contract speaks to itself. Like most the bidding war for him shows that like most front offices believe that, but he also had a lot of doubters. But also like what he did in the World Series, obviously just like incredible from a historical perspective. Like in this century, I mean, it's right up there with like Randy Johnson and Madison Bumgarner. But in Japan, where it's like so common to throw like 100 pitch bullpens like every third day and stuff, like it was probably just like, yeah, you know, I can do this, like, you know, need me to throw another 50 pitches, like I can do it. So I think
it was less appreciated because they're like, of course he'd throw on no day's rest, what's the big deal?
That's like a Tuesday at Koshien.
Yeah, I think he was set up for that. But I mean the reaction to it is just that, I mean, he's had his legendary status, like, basically cemented, right? And I think that's huge for him because up until this year, he has been known a little bit as, like, a postseason underperformer. Like, in NPB, he was good in the playoffs. He was good, but he had his worst career start ever in the Japan series in 2023, game one. He gave up 7 runs. And he had a lot of these outings where he was just like not that sharp. And then you look at like, you know, the Padres in the DS last year, not that sharp. But then the World Series against the Yankees. And then ever since then, this guy has just elevated. And again, I just think that players like this, it's like proof that just because you're like have the reputation of maybe not being that great in high pressure, that doesn't mean it's going to be there forever. It might be a small sample thing. It might just be you need to get over some jitters. And now he is arguably like the best big game pitcher in the league.
I'm giving him the ball before basically anybody else.
How much of a character was his personal coach, was the sensei? Because I think for us, like it's very odd because sometimes you're very used to seeing the pitching coach and the assistant pitching coach and all the pitching coaches working with the pitchers on their team. But for Yamamoto and really for Sasaki, Ohtani is that. He does do that.
Yep.
But for Yamamoto and Sasaki, like they kind of have their own guys and they just sort of do their own thing with their own people. And so we kind of knew that. But in terms of his name is Yada, right?
Yeah, Osamu, like, Yada, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was he known, or is this like a bunch of Americans pretending that we discovered something again?
He was known, but like not to this extent, certainly. And okay. I think Yamamoto is just very unique in that way, right? In terms of just how much he puts into his training regimen, his routine. Tread Athletics has done like a really great video about just, I mean, like the flexibility this guy has, right? Like the, you know, you see him doing like cartwheels and just like stretching out in just ways that I don't think other MLB players can do. And maybe there's something to this, you know, because he has been incredibly durable. I mean, he's been giving you 170, 180, 190 innings even for so many consecutive seasons dating back to his career with the Oryx Buffaloes. Missed time with that, you know, injury in 2024, but this year again it was a full season, and there must be something to it because this guy is durable and he is as sharp as they get.
Oh, we could go on forever about Yamamoto, but we are going to finish with the topic that I don't know is going to include Yamamoto. I hope it does. This dude can throw forever, and that is the World Baseball Classic, which is coming up in a few months. And my goodness, are we excited? I don't think we're excited enough. I think that this is, wow, I can't wait for this tournament to happen again. Obviously, we're talking about the defending champs here. I guess the most basic big picture question I have for you at this stage, we know Samurai Japan has been doing some scrimmaging. They've had they're already getting after it. You know, Team USA still has like 25 more players to find, presumably. But Team, you know, Samurai Japan, I think they have a pretty good sense of who's going to be on the team, but also maybe not. I don't know if Imai is going to be able to play if he signs. Like, we'll see about all that. Bigger picture, how different should we expect the team to look? Is there one player you want to shout out, almost calling your shot as someone that maybe isn't in MLB yet or isn't coming to MLB that we should know about as we get ready for the WBC?
Yeah, I think the most difficult part right now is that, so the previous manager, Hideki Kuriyama, who was Ohtani's manager with the Fighters, he retired. Now you have Hirokazu Iwata. And, you know, his recruiting process is obviously different. Like, he maybe doesn't have the same kind of rapport with a lot of the MLB players. So there is going to be, you know, a little bit of unknown there as to who ends up on the team from the MLB side. And then, like you said, how about Murakami? How about Okamoto? How about Imai? Like, are these guys going to be allowed to play in the WBC? Hopefully, yes. Like, I imagine, you know, that's going to be a part of, you know, the negotiation process with their future team as well. They're probably going to bring that up. But, you know, you're not going to have Lars Nootbaar there more than likely because Nootbaar is, you know, going to be injured. So that's going to be different. There's a lot of potential names that will be there that are not in MLB yet. My guy, Shunpei Yamashita back there, I don't know if he's going to be on the team because he's had his, you know, injury problems himself. He has back issues. But in terms of talent, Shunpei Yamashita for the Oryx Buffaloes is, I think, we're going to be one of the best pitchers ever to come out of MPB. So, you know, 96 plus on the fastball up to 99, just a disgusting curveball and splitter off of it. So I really hope he's on the team. Also, Shota Morishita for the Hanshin Tigers is an outfielder, had a great year this year, career season, you know, and he might play center field, ? Because Nootbaar is not there. So keep an eye on him.
Yes, but I am fascinated about, right, because I believe we saw like Yoshida signed and immediately went and played. So there is some precedent for a version of that happening, but I can imagine whoever signs Imai to be their number two or three might be like, hey, dude, maybe not. And then what happens with, I mean, Ohtani for sure. Is Yamamoto? I hope so, but we will see. We will see what happens there.
Yeah,
so,
and to your point, yeah, Senga, right when he signed, was not participating. So there is some kind of precedent for that where maybe Imai is not there. But if he's allowed, then, you know, you got a rotation that includes, you know, Ohtani, Yamamoto, Imai, and then take your pick of the litter of just all these great pitchers in MPB, Hiroya Miyagi, Hiromi Ito, Shunpei Yamashita. So
that's the funny thing is it's like like, with all due respect to Imanaga and Kikuchi and whatever, it's like, I know what that looks like.
I've seen this.
Yeah.
I would rather let me watch Miyagi in, you know, in Lone Depot Park, please. I'm much more interested in that. So we will see how the roster shakes out. Obviously, Yuri is doing an incredible job covering Samurai Japan as that roster gets put together. So again, we could have you on every week and do this all off season long, but we will let you go here. So please, Yuri, let people know where they can support your work, follow your work. I mean, even just on Twitter alone, you're going to get a lot, but I know you have a lot more to offer. So please let people know where they can find your stuff.
Yeah. Thanks so much for having me on. I'm Yaku Cosmo on Twitter/X. I have my own website, yakucosmo.com as well, with some MPB stats from recent years, japanball.com. I have a weekly MPB newsletter that I do, including during the off season. And then I do articles pretty regularly for the World Baseball Network. And then you can find me on a bunch of other places as well. But yeah, that's mainly it.
Thank you for making the time. Nobody better at what you do. We appreciate you waking up early across the large pond and making some time for us.
Thanks.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Before we hop into Good, Bad, Ugly, we have some news to talk about. Let's go around the league. Let's dive right into the qualifying offers, because this is both important and somewhat confusing if you are not a huge loser like we are, because I think oftentimes people like us will talk past a certain level of fan and be like, oh, that person accepted the QO. And I'm currently reading a book on Chernobyl. And, you know, something that the Soviets used to do was just acronym everything so that people like got confused about what was what. And I don't want to do that here on the podcast, right? I don't want to confuse the populace in such a way. So the QO stands for qualifying offer. Jordan, why don't you just give a brief explainer of what the qualifying offer is and why it exists?
Man. Oh, vintage Jake Mintz. We should explain this. Jordan, please explain it. I'll do my best. Literally, the number of times this happens
I'll do it.
On the show I'll do it. Is one of my favorite. It's one of my I'll favorite sequences. No, I'm happy to. I'm just, again, it's without fail. It's like, we should slow down and explain this. Jordan, please.
Jordan, I'm reading this book about Chernobyl. Can you explain nuclear fission, please?
You clearly, if you want to keep dragging, by all means, I was not prepared for that transition, but it was a good way to reference it.
Okay.
This is true in baseball. You're right. We're just throwing out acronyms left and right. That's very common. And if we are ever going too fast or just throwing out too many letters too quickly, then please call us out. baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. Anyway, the point of the qualifying offer is essentially to give teams a way to extend a real effort to keep their players and then be compensated as such if those players leave. Now, this is in some respects a problematic element of quote-unquote free agency, seeing as it is a direct deterrent to teams that are going to sign players that have qualifying offers attached to them, because they would have to give up a draft pick. If you lose a player that you give a qualifying offer to, you then gain a draft pick. If you sign a player that has received a qualifying offer, you then lose a draft pick. So that's impacting the level of free agency and interest. The offer itself is a one-year contract worth a number that is slowly going up, because it is a number calculated by the average salary of the 125 highest paid players.
The mean salary.
Mean salary, yes, which in this case is $22.025 million, which is, yeah, that's a real good chunk of change, but it is just a 1 year deal. And so essentially, when the free agents receive the qualifying offer, they are trying to decide, okay, do I want to stay where I am at for this 1 year deal that is fairly lucrative, and not deal with trying to get a larger contract of guaranteed money with the draft pick attached to me, because some teams will be like, oh, I don't want to give Trent Grisham 3 years and give up a draft pick. That doesn't sound very fun. And you can only receive the QO once, which means that if you take it the first time and you go have a great season and you go back to free agency again, you cannot get it again. So it won't be your problem again next year. Now, there are some other problems that could surface next year, as we know, for players reaching free agency. And maybe that was or wasn't part of the calculus here, which is kind of compelling. But the point is, the players can say, all right, you know what? I'll stick around. I'll do it. I'll stay here for 1 year and $22 million. And the teams, clearly, when they offer it, now at the very top of the market, are certainly not expecting them to accept it, right? Kyle Tucker and so on. And the players, teams are just like, great, we'll get a draft pick, we'll move on. But then there's these interesting cases in between where teams have to decide, all right, if this player accepts, are we comfortable with him being on our team for $22 million? And in the case of Trent Grisham, Gleyber Torres, Shota Imanaga, Brandon Woodruff, I sure hope that these teams knew that this was a possibility. Of course they knew it was a possibility. But there was certainly some debate about how likely it was that Grisham and Gleyber Torres and Shota Imanaga and Brandon Woodruff would accept. But they did. And these four players will remain with their teams, which has impacts on the market elsewhere, where it's like, okay, now these are four players that are not available for teams to get as free agents. Does this impact, okay, how much other players are now worth because so-and-so is not available? The thing I focused on, I wrote about yesterday at Yahoo, was basically like, okay, well, what does this mean for the next steps for these four teams, which are all four playoff teams? And I think that that's what I kind of want to focus on here today, more than like, did Trent Grisham make a good business decision? Because the decision's made, and we kind of have to just deal with that and move forward. How is this going to impact us moving forward?
I want to push back against one idea that I saw just percolating a bit online, this is somehow related to the impending labor tsunami that will, freeze the game at this point next year. I think that's completely counterintuitive. If you told me, hey, brother, next year there's going to be a work stoppage. You can either sign a one-year deal for this upcoming year, or you can sign a lengthier deal that guarantees you money during the period where nothing's going on. That's what I would want, right? Like the uncertainty, like you're not, I understand like when you're playing, the money is not always coming in the same way. But like what I'm saying is if you're like, oh, I don't know what the system's going to be, like you want to lock yourself in. And I think that each of these four situations are separate than the larger economic dynamics going on in the game. I think it's a good, like, let's just start with Woodruff. Like, this is he called it a no-brainer. He's been in Milwaukee for a really long time. I think he likes being there. It's that simple. Do you see anything deeper than that with him and the Brewers?
No. I mean, you'd be like, well, why did he accept this if he declined his $20 million player option? What's the difference? He also got a $10 million buyout on that already. So, I mean, he's essentially already locked in $30 million plus for this at least little run. You could say, all right, no, that counts really talking about 2025, not 2026. But financially, I think Brandon Woodruff also realized that this would have been an interesting time to go to free agency with how he finished the year, which was back on the injured list, and some of the risks that I think could be associated with committing to him long term. But yeah, I think his is the most simple because he's by far the most comfortable there. And yeah, of course, he's the longest tenured Brewer, and they just had the best record in baseball, and he still feels like he owes them stuff. He said, I recognize the Brewers have never paid a pitcher this much money, so like this is not a small thing that they're willing to do, and that doesn't take that lightly either. So good for Brandon Woodruff. I'm glad he will stay a Brewer. The other three, I think, are much more interesting. I think Imanaga, because we had this kind of contractual labyrinth to get to this point where the Cubs declined 3 years and 57 option in his deal, then Imanaga declined 115, but then accepts 122 in the form of the QO. I thought, remember when this first happened, I was like, oh wow, that's kind of a sad way for this to end. But really the Cubs were just like, no, we like Imanaga. We just don't really want to commit to him as he enters his, mid-30s. And it's more about like, yes, he should be a part of our rotation this year. What I'm compelled by with this is like, okay, the Cubs could conceivably just run back the rotation they had last year, which in some respect was good because they was like top 10 ERA and they threw a bunch of strikes, but they also didn't strike anybody out and really trusted their elite defense to work behind them. If you're going to let Kyle Tucker walk, how are you making your team better? And that could still be signing a top tier starting pitcher and moving Colin Ray back to a bulk role, right? Like the pivot from Kyle Tucker might not necessarily be just getting another right fielder. You know, when you look at their roster, that seems unlikely, honestly, that they would just add another outfielder. So the Cubs are interesting to me. What they do with their pitching, is Imanaga viewed as, because we'll never really know the degree to which the teams are honest about how much they expected players to accept it versus decline it is always interesting. Because once they accept, what are you going to be like? You're going to publicly say, damn it. Oh, God, it sucks. This guy's back. Like, no, you might get a little reporting here and there being like, some officials were surprised. But you don't really know. And so I'm sure the Cubs will welcome back Imanaga with open arms. But it's possible that in the inner workings of the Cubs front office, they were like, hopefully Imanaga leaves and we can go sign a better pitcher. You know, I don't know. They could still do that. But that's what's always also interesting dynamic with this stuff.
Also, the funny thing specifically with Imanaga is like, hey, we believe in you, but like only for this year. Like they declined the team option for two more years. So towing the line of faith in a employee in that regard.
Yes.
Can you imagine, Jordan, if I was like, hey, this upcoming season for the podcast, I can't wait to work with you. The following season, no desire at all to work with you.
We're going to see. Prove it. Do it again. Strike out more batters. And we'll see. I mean, again, I think the Cubs are way up there for just like, what are we doing? What are we doing to get better? Because especially when we just mentioned it, Brewers are kind of running it back. And while you can say that that might have some issues once you get to the postseason, right now, Brewers look a lot better than the Cubs. I don't feel bad saying that. Mm-hmm. So we will see if the Cubs can do enough this winter to change that perception going into the regular season. Let's talk about the other two, Gleyber Torres and Trent Grisham, who I believe we had back-to-back on our top 50 free agents list in somewhere in the teens as rock-solid, you know, position players. Which of these do you want to start with first?
Let's do Grisham. So I think the decision to accept makes some sense. What he put together last year, offensively, career year, definitely was enough of an outlier compared to his career production, where I think teams would be skeptical. Now, if he goes out and does it again, you could see him getting a pretty significant deal just because he's still not 30 years old. And I think the age component, that's relatively rare, and that's on Grisham's side. As it pertains to the Yankees, this is fascinating. Because the Yankees have been very public about their desire to bring Cody Bellinger back. And I think that if Grisham had left, it would have heightened the likelihood of a Bellinger reunion just because that's an open spot in the outfield and that's $22.025 million that they can toss around. Do you believe that Grisham's return changes the equation on Bellinger?
I mean, they've already said publicly no, it doesn't. I think it has to some degree. I mean, Bellinger is going to have a lot of suitors, right? Like, this is not as simple as, like, all right, let's just work things out. I don't think this is a situation. And again, Boris is a big part of this, but I don't think if we compare it to the Josh Naylor situation, where clearly as soon as the season ended, Josh Naylor and the Mariners were like, how can we figure out a way to keep this going? I'm sure Cody Bellinger had a great time as a Yankee and the Yankees loved him. I don't sense that that is what is happening here. He is going to go try and get the long contract that he has essentially now sought for a while. And that could be a lot of other teams. So it just makes it harder. I don't think it stops them from doing it because running it back, I know, is not always the thing that you want to see from teams that come up short. And the Yankees are the number one. They always want more, 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 something different, something fresh. The Yankees had the most productive outfield in baseball last year by a country mile. Like, if they run this back, even if you factor in some regression from Grisham, you're going to have a really good outfield and probably a really good lineup, you know?
I think
now that Grisham is Bellinger, the one you have in first, yeah.
Yes. You make, like, Bellinger and Grisham were not great in October. I think that's small sample size more than anything. I think if you bring back Grisham and Bellinger and the Yankees don't win the World Series, it won't be because of Grisham and Bellinger. You know what I mean? Or like if they don't win the division. Like, I don't think that is a weak link on the team. Mm-hmm. But if they do, with Grisham coming back, if they do decide to pass on Bellinger, it raises the question like, okay, then where are you getting better? Similar to the Cubs. Where is the improvement on the roster going to be? because the starting rotation is, even with injuries to Cole and Rodon that are going to keep them out at the start of the year, they'll presumably be back by June. And then you have those two, you have Fried, you have Cam Schlittler, who's going to need innings. You still have Heel. Clark Schmidt will be back at some point. Like, they have a lot of arms that are going to need and deserve to get innings. I totally forgot about Will Warren. And so I think that I'm just fascinated to see what the Yankees do. I do think in the end that they do go and get Bellinger and bring him back. We will see. Last one here is Gleyber Torres, who took his $22.025 million qualifying offer from the Detroit Tigers. He did not receive one last year after hitting free agency with the Yankees, which is interesting because the season was not dissimilar to what he did this year.
Yeah. It's so funny to think that, like, a year ago, if you were like, okay, so the Yankees aren't giving Gleyber Torres a qualifying offer, but in a year, they're going to give Trent Grisham a qualifying offer. After, like, if you said that a year ago after Trent Grisham was, like, totally irrelevant on the 2024 team, you'd be like, okay, baseball is weird. I think in this case, I was also a little bit surprised. I think for Gleyber, same kind of thing with Grisham, where he's still relatively young for a free agent. If he thinks he can do it again, have a fully healthy season. He was battling a hernia in the second half, which he got surgery for after the season. He was awesome for the first 2 months and really struggled down the stretch, but he just played through it. If he thinks he can do it again in Detroit, where he now knows, like, all right, yeah, this can be a place where I can succeed, then thinks he can cash in next winter. Again, these guys are not necessarily thinking too hard about the lockout. I think in most cases, they're like, yeah, I'll just do it again and I'll get a contract, whether that's if that's November 20th next year, great. If that's, you know, March, sure. To me, this is another one, and we didn't even talk about what it means for the Yankees in terms of, like, the next wave of outfielders, whether it's Jason Dominguez, Spencer Jones. I'm just so interested in what this means for just how the rest of the Tigers infield shakes out. The left side of the Tigers infield now is a mishmash of, like, five or six guys, whether it's Colt Keith or McKinstry, and Javi Baez is still there and still owed $48 million over the next 2 years. And Trey Sweeney, it seemed like they really believed in, but then maybe didn't. And then you have top prospect Kevin McGonigal, who's going to be ready at some point soon. If Gleyber wasn't back, I would think he would have a chance to make the team out of camp, whether that wasn't second, short, or third. Now that's a little bit harder, but he also still might be their best option. So what I really wrote about yesterday is the Tigers just need to find more hitters that are everyday guys. And Gleyber's one of them. That's one guy that they know is that.
Yeah.
And credit to him. But as we saw, like, the mixing and matching is fun to a point, but you kind of got to find some dudes that you are excited to get four and five at bats every day. And that's a shorter list than most of the good teams. So that's what they really need to figure out. And maybe that is Colt Keith. I mean, it's fine to rule him out. Is it's too early to do that, but they have to figure that out. And so Gleyber gives them one of those hitters, but also makes it a little bit harder to work in kind of the other guys that we really want to see more of.
Three more moves here before we go to Good, Bad, Ugly. Trade. Grayson Rodriguez goes from the Baltimore Orioles to the Los Angeles Angels in exchange for outfielder Taylor Ward. I'll start and do this from the O's perspective. Grayson Rodriguez, a former top pitching prospect for the Orioles, missed all of 2025 with a variety of different injuries, missed the second half of 2024 with a lat issue. He had debuted in 2023. I watched his debut at your parents' house. I'm now remembering very vividly, Jordan. And
yeah, wow.
G-Rod never became, for the Orioles, what he was supposed to be, which was a frontline, no-doubt starter. He was indisputably one of the top pitching prospects in the sport, but it is a reminder that top pitching prospects in the sport don't always matriculate into the top pitchers. That is a sad reality of the game that we enjoy so much. But Rodriguez, it seems the Orioles' willingness to part with him here is a recognition that, one, they don't believe he will be able to stay healthy enough moving forward to provide value, even though he has four more years of control. Two, the Orioles don't seem to think that the ceiling is there anymore. Rodriguez, in the time that he has spent being healthy in the big leagues, has not been a frontline guy. The fastball shape is below what you would expect from a number one or number two starter. And his numbers were squarely average. And then three, I mean, I think it's fair to hypothesize and speculate that maybe there was some sort of relationship issue going on here. Because getting rid of a player this young with still this much runway, he's still only 26, I believe, with four more years of control left, is surprising for an Orioles team that has generally held on to players with a lot of control. And then the last point I think is worth making from the Orioles side of things is that maybe it's a sign that, President of Baseball Operations, Mike Elias, is putting his foot on the gas pedal a bit, is trading players with control for players with less control in order to kind of open the window a little bit more and, quotes, go for it. It's an odd way to do that, I think. But it definitely makes a little bit of sense.
Yeah, I think, the arguing over the exact trade value and whether it's a good deal for one side or the other is a worthy debate for sure. But I think it's more about what it signifies, right? This is a really aggressive maneuver, which is why we should talk about Taylor Ward, because that's what we're talking about here. Yes, I think I agree with a lot of what you said, that there could be a lot of reasons that are driving them away from Grayson Rodriguez. He was the last pick that they made before Mike Elias came in, right? So there's no personal attachment. That's a real thing in the industry. Front offices are way more likely to stay attached to the guys that they picked, right? And they saw Grayson have success and an amount of success. And that's what's hard, because while I think what Grayson was before his injuries is a little overrated, it's not nothing. We're not talking about a nothing sample. He was showing glimpses along the way where it's like you can see it. But a year and a half without pitching is a substantial thing. I know Grayson now saying, I'm healthy, I'm ready to go. I hope that's the case. We love this dude. We've had him on the podcast. We're always going to root for him. I think the dynamic that's really interesting here is it's like the Orioles are in a weird place, because so often when we reference trades and we talk about any moves, it's so much about the historical context of the franchise, what they've done, what they haven't done. And it's very funny that in this case, everyone's like, wow, Angels, brilliant. It's like, maybe, but let's be honest, guys. Why are we giving the Angels the benefit of the doubt? Why are we saying, man, those Angels, they really sure cooked again here? And I hope they do for the purpose of Grayson having a great, long, successful career. But from the Orioles' perspective, it's more of the, oh my gosh, they've traded away so many great pitchers. That hurts. But also this weird part of it where it's like, don't you want Mike Elias to stop holding on to 2029 and just do what's yes right for 2026, which in this yes case means going and getting an upgrade in Taylor Ward. Now, the problem is that you just gave Tyler O'Neill all this money. And so, and that went terribly wrong. And so now they tried that and now they're trying to fix it. And so you, on one hand, you want to give credit because it's like, well, you're acknowledging that Tyler O'Neill was not the answer and getting a better player in Taylor Ward. But also you're still stuck with this weird roster where you have both of them and you have all these other moving parts. So just all these different things that are, I think, inspiring the reaction to this trade. Obviously, yeah, if Grayson Rodriguez is awesome in 2028, 2029, people are going to be like, man, what a stupid trade. But the Orioles need to win right now. And Taylor Ward can help them do that, probably more likely than Grayson Rodriguez in the immediate future. We also have a long offseason ahead of us where the Orioles can add pitching, and they're going to have to do that to really people see the vision.
This only makes sense if the Orioles go and add arms in other ways. I like this move for the Angels just because it's hard to get a guy with the amount of, raw talent that Grayson Rodriguez has, especially for an organization that sucked at developing arms internally. And so for them to take a shot and basically say, hey, maybe we'll get 1.5 good years out of this guy. Sure. Trading Taylor Ward opens up their outfield a little bit more. It allows Joe Adell to move to a corner. Maybe they backfill center field now. What's funny about it, though, is like Perry Minasian, who's the GM of the Angels, he also needs to win now, because if he doesn't win this year, they're probably going to fire his ass. And so I always find it funny when a team like that, where the GM is on a hot-ish seat, is like looking kind of long-term here. But if Grayson contributes this year, I think it is very easy to envision the Angels winning this deal, right? Because you are, you kind of know what Taylor Ward's going to be. Like, he's going to be like 118 to 108 OPS plus and play an average corner outfield and, you know, hit 27 homers, right? Whereas Grayson Rodriguez could be nothing, or he could make two all-star teams for you. You just don't know, right? Two other moves before, just we'll fly through these. Braves re-sign Raisel Iglesias, 1 year, $16 million. Real G's move in silence like Anthopoulos. Just tweeting it out like the Braves always do. And then they swing a deal trading for Mauricio Dubon to add a utility guy to their roster. Maybe just be the starting shortstop, sending away Nick Allen, who took the majority of time at shortstop for them last year. Just a reminder that the Braves core is good, and this is a team that's going to try to win in 2026, as they freaking should. And Iglesias, as bad as he was in the first half and as much as he contributed to the Braves, like not being in the mix, he was awesome. Awesome after the All-Star break and looked as good as he ever has. I think it's notable that the Braves were able to get him on a one-year deal. I would not have been surprised if Iglesias had secured a multi-year pact despite his age. I believe he's 36. And so good for him and good for the Braves.
Yeah, there's no reason, and I think there was already reporting that there was substantial interest in him, but this is just one where, is this a one-off? He wanted to go back quickly, let's just get it over with, move on. Or are we going to start to see this relief market pick up here in the near future? Because you assume that it's going to take one, and maybe he wasn't considered at the very top of the market, but not far off. I mean, we had him on our top 50. Like, yeah. This dude is as proven of a closer as we have, really, in the league. So I'm huge credit to Atlanta for doing that, and I would expect them to keep making stuff happen. Because generally, the Braves are like, all right, these are our goals. We're just going to go out and do them. And they generally do not sit around and just wait for stuff. Like, they're going to make it happen. So I expect them to continue to do that. I think the Braves are going to remain active, and we're going to wake up in February and be like, oh, wait a minute. Holy crap. They got a lot of good baseball players. This is a team that we should expect to be relevant in the postseason once again. All right. We had a few other transactions. We're going to save them, push them, because we got to do good, bad, ugly. The other thing just to mention is that we got the non-tender deadline coming up tonight. We'll have a bunch more free agents. Some minor trades will happen today for sure. We also have like a lot of other big picture MLB news involving the TV deals and all that stuff. We're going to get to that next week in our show before Thanksgiving. But for now, it's Friday. So let's get to the real fun. It's time for the good, the bad, the ugly.
One thing good, one thing bad. One thing odd, wonky, bizarre, Dan Ugla from the week that was. I'll begin with a good. Edmundo Sosa and Christopher Sanchez are either still doing or just finished a Euro trip together with their wives. This is adorable and awesome. Edmundo Sosa's, I believe it's his wife, Deliz, and Christopher Sanchez's wife, Kaimari. They went to Milan and then Lake Como in Italy for Jesus Luzardo's wedding. And then they said, you know what? Let's gallivant around Europe as a quartet.
Keep it going.
And they did. So they went to Greece together, and then they went to Paris together. And there are some awesome pictures. You should go to both their Instagrams. Like, it's great. All four of them, like, coordinating their outfits, like the four of them coordinating their outfits together for pictures. If I was a baseball player and you were a baseball player and we just could, like, have, you know, infinite money hack in the winter, mm-hmm. I would like to think that, you know, us and our wives would do things like this. And I think it's cool that they're traveling in a pack to go see Europe. Yep. So cheers to the European Panamanian and Dominican Phillies.
Yeah, I love it. You know, I don't have personal Instagram, so my Instagram is just like following a bunch of baseball players. And so, you know, I'm used to the offseason. It's like, all right, there is like obviously a huge portion that's just going to Cancun, as people make the jokes, but it's true. Yes, there are plenty of players that go to Cancun. There are plenty of players that are just going to their respective tropical islands. And so it's just great when you see Sim mix it up a little bit, right? I remember when Tyler Glasnow was bopping around Thailand. It's like, all right, nice. This is fun. This is interesting. Matt Festa just got married and Cal Raleigh was hanging out in Dublin. They were getting married in Dublin, Ireland. It's like, great. We love this. You know, so give me some baseball players in odd spaces, I think is always compelling because, you know, we understand and totally don't blame them for just going to whatever tropical beach of their choosing. But when they mix it up, I love to see a little bit more of a diverse tourism is very fun.
Also, seeing Christopher Sanchez standing in front of the Eiffel Tower just like feels right physically. Like, no pitcher is built more like the Eiffel Tower. I'm not really sure what that means, but it just makes sense, man.
I think you're right.
Like, I'm looking at Edmundo Sosa in front of the Eiffel Tower, and I'm like, that's not his building.
No.
But then I'm looking at Christopher Sanchez, I'm like, that's his building.
He belongs. I just hope that the other tourists there were like, oh my God, that's the guy that got all 32nd place votes in the NL Cy Young. Holy crap. That's him.
Is that the guy who was traded for Curtis Mead? And Mr. Sanchez, oh, we have a moment.
That Toros legend, Christopher. Okay, all right. Here we go. It's time for my good.
Will you sign my beret?
My good this week is the inaugural draft for the Women's Professional Baseball League, which happened last night. This is a league that we spoke about on the pod a few months ago. I think it was a few months ago, right? When you went to the tryouts in Washington, D.C. This is the first Women's Professional Baseball League in decades, obviously, since the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, of course, well-known from a league of their own. Dissolved in 1954. We're back, baby. We got women's pro baseball, and this is going to be freaking sweet. Now, this is a league that will take place in Springfield, Illinois next summer in August. It will be a neutral location in one spot. However, there'll be four teams, and this draft was so cool to watch because this is the most simple way that I can put it. Obviously, the historic element of this is, I don't have to explain that. And there's what this means for women's pro baseball, for sure. Like, duh. But to me, just as like a baseball dork, what I do all the time is just learning about more baseball players, right? There you go. Jake did a good costume change there if you're watching on YouTube. Is that like, I just get to learn about a bunch more baseball players. Like, I got to watch this and be like, oh, damn, like, this woman's been dominating in Canada for the last 15 years. Oh, this Japanese pitcher, you know, won this World Cup at the U18s, like all these things. And yes, there are some familiar names. Kelsey Whitmore, of course, first overall. She's been a trailblazer in this space in recent years. Ayami Sato, who's the most accomplished Japanese pitcher and probably one of the most important figures in modern, you know, women's baseball. But then you've got some other names that I'm being familiarized with from all around the world. This is a global draft. I mean, we were getting players from the Dominican, players from Curacao, players from Mexico, so many players from Canada, which is really, really interesting. It's something that I want to kind of dig into and learn more about. And then, I mean, Jake Mintz, one of our close friends from childhood, was drafted in this draft, which is the coolest thing in the world. Shouts out to Stephanie Everett, selected by the team from Boston, I believe in the fourth round. And we'll talk more about Steph, but we should probably just honestly have her on the show. But she's someone that played baseball with us growing up at the baseball camp we worked at. I remember vividly Steph catching a Jake Mintz bullpen. Just a hilarious vision.
It's online.
And
it's online, and that video.
Here's Steph all these years later getting drafted in the WPBL, which is absolutely sweet. But I just love the experience of learning about all these baseball players of such a huge range of ages. I mean, we've got like 18-year-olds getting drafted. We've got 37-year-olds getting drafted. There's this girl, Rain Padgham from Canada, who I was reading about, who touched 83 when she was 15. Like, what? Why had I not heard about her before? You know, like these are the things that I'm so excited to learn more about as this league gets more recognition. So we could go on forever, but this is obviously good. I'm very excited about this league.
I do briefly just want to talk about Steph. who you mentioned, who is just someone that we have known for like our whole lives. And I, this morning and last night, have just like been sending the picture of her, like with her arms crossed, like on the Boston team to everyone we know, because it's like, this is so cool. And then when I'm doing this, I'm like, you know, I've probably seen her like three times in the last 6 years. And then I'm thinking about all of these women and the lives that they're leading and all the people that they know and all the people who are proud of them. And like, it's just a great reminder of what this type of, like what sports is and how many tentacles it touches. And so congrats to everybody who got drafted. I'm excited to follow the league as it moves forward. I have a bad. You have a bad?
Yeah, let's do bad.
I have a bad.
Yo, I got a bad. What's your bad?
Robinson Cano. Now, this was a good bad.
What was bad about this?
This is a bad good, yeah, maybe. Robinson Cano cried last week, which is okay. On this podcast, we are very much in favor of crying, particularly in public and particularly for athletes. Robinson Cano, who I would describe, unfortunately, as within the American baseball community, as disgraced to a certain extent due to multiple PED suspensions. He is also simultaneously one of the greatest players of the century and one of the greatest Dominican players in the history of the sport. And last weekend, a Dominican All-Star team from the Dominican Winter League played a Puerto Rican All-Star team from the Puerto Rican Winter League at Citi Field in New York. And Robinson Cano got like the ceremonial send-off cap wave thing for like 4 minutes, like 3 to 4 minutes, standing ovation. He like scoops the dirt, you know, off the field from Citi Field where he played for the Mets, put it in his pocket. Like, this was an emotional thing. And the reason it is bad is it didn't have to end this way, you know? And as you're watching Robinson Cano walk off the field, you can just, you look, he's financially, he's secure. I'm not like feeling bad for him necessarily, but you could just see the regret and the bad decisions that he made that will forever taint his legacy as a player. Those are unavoidable as you watch this video. And so it really bummed me out. And the only thing that is worse than all of that is that for this whole clip, he has the sticker still on the brim of his cap that he did not take off, which is shameful and really should never happen to a baseball player.
Yeah, Cano's a really weird just player to think about. Obviously, like, him going to the Mariners is one of the most oh my god moments of like my baseball fandom following existence. And he was awesome in Seattle and he was awesome in New York. And I agree. It is, again, he really shows the difference between getting suspended once and getting suspended twice. There's a lot of guys that get suspended once and everybody forgets about it and moves on and cheers them. You get suspended twice, you really do not, you're just not going to be taken seriously.
Fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, don't get fooled again, baby.
It
sucks.
But you know what? It does not take away my enjoyment of watching Robinson Cano, who is an absolute beast, sure, and continues to play at age 43 in the Dominican Winter League. He was batting, I think, fourth for Estrellas the other night. All right, my bad this week is J.J. Bleda was J.J. Bleda-fa'd. Here's why this is bad. It's not that J.J. Bleda regressed and had a bad season and kind of fell out of favor with the A's, although that is obviously what happened. But it's a reminder of one of our favorite segments that has become an annual segment, which is let's look at the renderings of the new Vegas A's stadium and see who they are highlighting as no doubt staples of their future. The first edition gave a lot of love to Zach Geloff. That did not go so well. This past year, it was a lot of Brent Rooker. He's held up his end of the bargain. Brent Rooker's been awesome. But there was images of J.J. Bleda jerseys in the stands. J.J. Bleda was imagining, like, the imaginary batting order on the scoreboard. J.J. Bleda was batting third. He was quite good in 2024. But now he is gone. He has been DFA'd by the A's and replaced by players who are better than him. So whenever the A's do their latest rendering, their next renderings in 2026, and we talk about them, just know that let's not trust who they're putting up there. Hopefully they're getting better at this, but I just, you know, JJ Bleday, not part of the A's future. This does not seem like he'll be on the Vegas A's, and that is bad.
Ugla. You know what we haven't talked about in a while? Baseball Pope.
People have been keeping us updated, which is great. Like, people have continued to send us Pope stuff. Now we will update. What's the Pope latest?
Pope date. Here's the latest update. Justin Ishbia, who earlier this year was effectively named as like the owner in waiting for the Chicago White Sox. He was going to buy the Twins, and then he was like, you know what? I'm from Chicago, I guess. I should just like increase my ownership stake of the White Sox. And then when Jerry Reinsdorf is done, either owning or living, the ownership will then move on to me. Since then, we have not heard really anything from Justin Ishbia at all about the setup. He gave a huge interview to John Greenberg at The Athletic based around just his interview with the Pope, or Justin Ishbia going to meet the Pope and handing the Pope a White Sox jersey. But this White Sox jersey, notably, is signed by every member of the 2005 White Sox team that won the World Series, the game at which we have a picture of the Pope attending. So this is like, true. I mean, we're getting close to first pitch Pope. Like, this Pope it game, Pope and Justin Ishbia relationship is really the next crucial step that we need. Crucial. Like, the odds of the Pope going to the rate and interacting with Colson Montgomery are exponentially higher today than they were a week ago. Now, the other thing about this piece from John Greenberg is, like, there's a lot of just Ishbia talking about the future of the White Sox in here. Quote, you'll never hear me say the word owner. I'm the steward of a community asset. Yes, comrade. Good perspective. There's Yoss. Like ballpark talk, right? Like, there's a ton of stuff in here where it's like, oh, maybe that shouldn't be buried beneath like a picture of the Pope. Whatever. All of this is to say, baseball Pope.
I haven't quite thought about who would catch the Pope first pitch.
Ooh.
Which, again, it's that is also an exercise treat it like who's on the team.
Any other first pitch.
You just send out the backup infielder. Go get him. You know,
who's the most Catholic player on the team?
Well, that I'm sure there is an answer to that question, but I don't know what it is. I can't wait for this next era of White Sox baseball. And that is, I mean that with all my heart. All right, we finish with my Ugla. This is very different than the Pope, and that's Blake Snell Twitch streaming. Here's what is Ugla about this. Well, it's
religions come in all shapes and sizes.
It's just so great. And Blake Snell has been streaming his whole career. This is how we got Slapdick Prospect. This is how we got, I mean, if you don't know what I'm referencing, you can Google it. He's amazing. It's even more amazing now that he's, you know, making truly like bonkers money. It's one thing when he was on the Rays and pre-arb and streaming, but now we're talking about one of the wealthiest players in the sport. And he's getting online every day to stream NBA 2K or whatever, and like taking chats and donations. I don't know if he's taking donations or whatever, but like, he just wants to be a streamer so badly. And it's so great. And what is so funny, someone left him a chat on a recent stream saying, Vladdy is your daddy. And Blake Snell is like, Vladdy's in Cancun. What are you talking about? And then as soon as he says that, Blake Snell leans back and he goes, oh, don't clip that. Let me live my life. Blake Snell, you don't have to be streaming 6 hours a day, but if you are, people are going to watch it and people are going to share it. Isn't that what you want? want people to watch your stream? You can't have it both ways, my guy. I love it. He's hilarious. I hope he continues to stream because it clearly gives him joy and it entertains people. And he has the right attitude. Like, he understands what it is to be a streamer. This is not a half-assing it. He's doing it. He's really doing the thing. And for that, I commend him. But you can't be going around. Don't clip it. I know streamers do that sometimes, but it's like, well, what are you doing? What are you doing? You could go off and be offline like all the other baseball players, or you can do this and invite all that comes with it.
So I also would like to push back on the concept of Vladdy being in Cancun. I think this is an overuse of the send him to Cancun phrasing. I think if you lose in game 7 of the World Series, you're going to Cancun at the same time as everyone.
That's,
you
know, a good, like, point. That's a good, like, point. Sure. Yeah.
They sent the Reds to Cancun, right? The Reds were in Cancun after the scrimmage. I think Vladdy is not, like, they were too close
but,
to
but also,
be Cancun-ified.
It's fine. Like, Snell can talk his stuff and that's whatever. He's not going to be fazed by whatever. I mean, I agree with you that yes, this is not the best use of it. But I'd rather hear it from the guy that won the World Series than hear it from the fan of the team that didn't make the playoffs.
So, sure.
You know, sure. Which is really when you hear it the most. So anyway, I love Snell. I think this is hilarious. But definitely Ugla that he's grinding like everybody else on Twitch. So anyway, all right. This was a delightfully long and wide-ranging show, as always. But that's what we do here in the off season. Another Friday edition of Baseball Barbacast. Thank you to Andrew Hartz, Ingrid Rosas for producing. Thanks to Yuri for joining us. What a beast that guy is, man. Oh man. If you're not supporting his stuff, if you're not reading, watching what he's putting out there, you are missing out. And I have a feeling we're going to have him on again this off season. Yeah, I said it. But until next week, everyone have a good weekend. More fun stuff coming next week. Oh, we got a staple of Baseball Barbacast coming back here. Yes, friends, it's time for the time capsule. Oh, yeah, I said it. So if you have time capsule thoughts for 2025, email baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. We're getting ready for that episode. But we'll be back on Tuesday. So enjoy the weekend. We'll talk to you all soon. Bye-bye.